Welcome to Dialogue Unbound, where we explore the intersections of Mormonism, current events, and scholarly thought. I'm Caroline Klein, co-editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought.
And I'm Margaret Olson Hemming, also co-editor of Dialogue. This week, we're taking a close look at one of the most intimate and symbolically charged aspects of Latter-day Saint life, temple garments.
Earlier this week, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints released new garment designs in the United States, featuring, for the first time ever, a sleeveless top. The rollout caused a sensation. The online ordering system reportedly crashed, and long lines formed at distribution centers as members, mostly women, waited hours to purchase the new designs.
This enthusiasm raises fascinating questions. Why were so many women so eager to get their hands on these garments? What does this moment tell us about the intersection of comfort, modesty, embodiment, and authority within contemporary Mormonism? How does this redesign fit within the longer history of garment changes, and what patterns emerge over time? And finally, how do changes in garment design reflect broader shifts in the church's approach to contemporary issues of gender?
To help us explore these questions, we are joined by two guests who have thought deeply about these issues. Nancy Ross is a professor at Utah Tech University and author of a forthcoming book called Mormon Garments, Sacred and Secret.
And we're also joined by Christine Hagland, former editor of Dialogue and current doctoral student at St. Louis University, whose writing has long examined the intersection of faith, feminism, and lived religious experience. Thank you both for being here.
Good to be here.
Thanks for the invitation.
We are so excited to have you both here. Both Margaret and I look up to you both and just are always impressed by what you have to say about these contemporary issues, particularly revolving around Mormonism and gender.
Okay, so let's jump right in. What do you see as the emotional or spiritual significance behind the strong demand for new garment design? And how do these emotional and spiritual significance, how does it connect to the obvious reason for demand, which is physical comfort?
Would you want to tackle that first, Christine, and then I'll follow?
Sure. I suspect that it's impossible to disentangle all of those things. Probably there are many women who are just happy that maybe clothing shopping will be a little bit easier. One of the interesting things to me about garments has been that it makes buying clothes and wearing clothes so much more difficult. And it cannot possibly have been the theological design of them to make us spend more time thinking about our clothing and our bodies. And yet that was the effect. And so in part, I think just that simple practicality of being able to shop in the modern United States without, having to constantly modify and wonder whether clothes will work is just a huge burden that's partially lifted, at least by a better design. And then I think also that whether or not women articulate this reason, I suspect that it is also at work that the institutional church did something that women wanted, and that their articulated desires mattered in this practical way. And that is an experience that Latter-day Saint women don't always have.
Yeah, I want to affirm everything that Christine just said. So the foundation for the book that myself and Jessica Finnegan and Larissa Cano Kindred have co-authored is a survey of more than 4,500 members of the church in 2014, asking them about their experiences with their garments, how they make meaning of their garments. So the three kind of big open-ended questions that people were answering were, what do your garments mean to you? How do you feel when you wear garments, and why do you wear garments? So some big open-ended questions around meaning. And what we found is that many women needed to separate what their garments meant from their experiences of their garments in order to be able to name positive things with their garments. So this kind of question of like meaning making and religiosity and like the physical embodied practice of like wearing garments continually. This isn't, you know, a practice that people really may get significant breaks from, or that's really structured to get significant breaks from. So like basically a continual for many Mormons, certainly when I was active LDS, this was a continual practice for me. I was doing it all the time, wearing garments. And that these are not like fundamentally separate categories, that you can't engage in a practice continually that has to do with your body and the intimate parts of your body, and then have comfort be something that sits in a separate and lesser category than spirituality. Understanding that these are like foundationally related, generally speaking, garments, or the history and progression of garments, has always followed like more trends in men's underwear. And that women have long made complaints and asked for changes, really since the beginning of garments, have made complaints and asked for changes in garments. And often their needs have been sidelined or dismissed as being frivolous. While when men have had needs related to garments, especially around military service, the church has been much more accommodating, and that has not come with a lot of like stereotyping of, you know, men as complainers, but rather the church creating, you know, adaptations to meet their needs. So this is, they're just a lot of difficult things in the mix with some of these changes, which were, you know, a committee in the early 20th century that produced a report, a letter to the first presidency with a number of suggestions for garment changes, actually recommended sleeveless garments. And there were a number of other changes that were recommended at that time, and the church adopted those other changes, but not sleeveless garments. So this has been most of a century in the making. So we might see this as a very, you know, the change of this week, but this has also been something that was suggested a long time ago.
Wow, that history is so interesting, especially that it is tracked with styles of men's underwear, but not women's underwear. That's really interesting. So I would love to hear, and Christine, you touched on this a little bit, about how this moment illustrates the relationship between women's lived experience and institutional decision-making in the LDS church.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, I don't know for certain because I don't have any special insight into conversations that happened in the church office building. So I'm guessing at all of this, but I do know that there have been surveys in the field besides Nancy's that, you know, that there have been official surveys that friends of mine have been asked to either answer online or even in some cases come and talk to someone about their experience wearing garments. So I know that a lot of women were actually asked in some official way about their experience. And then even more women had the chance to say something in various online forums where these questions were brought up of how wearing garments affects their health and how inconvenient and difficult it is when they are pregnant or nursing, or, you know, all of the various stages that women's bodies go through for which men's underwear is impractical. And so I think the sense that women's needs mattered somehow was kind of in the air, and women were emboldened to speak more openly about their garments online. And, it's interesting. The pushback came, at least from what I've seen, as at least as much from other women as from men. So women on, you know, on either side, women who want change and women who are deeply invested in the status quo, have profound emotional and spiritual responses to this experience of wearing garments. And so being able to at least have some of that discussion in the open instead of, you know, whispered with the temple matron's instructions or, you know, between mother and daughter, maybe, who have, you know, generationally different experiences of it, I think opened up a new way of communicating and expressing what they wanted. And it seems to me that the church has been hesitant to just say we are responding to women's requests, to women's articulated desires. I don't fully understand what that hesitancy is about. And yet I just don't think there's another way to read what is happening now than that the institutional church recognized that women, you know, just were saying no entirely, and that if they wanted women to continue wearing garments, that there was going to need to be some compromise. And it seems to me that is how to read what has happened here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that reminds me of Jana Rees's book that came out a few years ago on called The Next Mormons, about millennial Mormons. And I think one of the statistics that she talked about that was really surprising for lots of people was that this younger generation were feeling more and more able to decide when and where they were wearing their garments in a way that was not reflected in older generations. And so I imagine that kind of knowledge, that people were making decisions that these garments were not always working for their bodies and they were taking breaks from them or making choices about them, I think also must have prompted, like you were saying, Christine, prompted some discussions about what to do, given sort of a changing attitude amongst at least younger generations towards garments. And Nancy, you mentioned a little while ago some of the history of garments.
Yes.
But I want to ask you more, because it's really fascinating to hear about the various changes that have occurred with garments over time. And so I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit more about the history of garments and what are the patterns that emerge over time, particularly around changes. When are changes made and what are they in response to?
So these are all great. Like, I feel like there are just so many points of, you know, that I want to pick up and run with here, but we'll stick with garment history because I think that that is something that is not very widely known. The way, and I also have just was sitting on the plane today to the conference that I'm at, sitting next to another Mormon studies scholar, and who was telling me that in Jonathan Stapley's new book, which just dropped this week, I think that
last week.
Yeah, or last week, that there are discussions of such things from, like, you know, centering the church institution there. And for me, in thinking about garments and garment history, I really want to take a little bit of a different lens. I want to think about garments through fashion history, right? Like, and which is maybe not like super obvious. We love to center the church institution in a lot of our discussions around history in the church, but I think that there are other ways to think about garment history. I think when Joseph Smith instituted garments and when he created the first garments, we have this idea that garments were basically reflective of the underwear that already existed in the 1840s, and that is not true. So if we think about union, okay, so let's imagine in our mind some different styles of underwear, and let's imagine like union suit style underwear. And I feel like I want to draw on union suit style underwear from any number of like TV shows about the Wild West that I might have watched in the 80s or something, right? Like, and that is my reference point for like underwear in the 19th century. But union suit style underwear does not really come into fashion until the late 19th century, like the 1880s, the 1890s. So kind of like at the end of Brigham Young's life, not in Joseph Smith's time. But one of the things that we want to understand is that when Joseph Smith created garments, they were progressive underwear. And I know that that is like impossible for us to imagine in our present context, because garments are not progressive underwear, right? Like in our, you know, today, internet era context. But there were a lot of conversations in the mid-19th century around ideas of health reform. And at that time, women wore lots of layers of underwear, lots of petticoats, lots of like different layers of chemises and undershirts to both like keep the body warm, to absorb, you know, bodily fluids, and to like survive in the world. But the idea was often to keep the body warm, the sense that the body needed to be kept warm in order to be healthy. And in the mid-19th century, there are a lot of health reform and fashion reform movements that kind of emerge, saying that, you know, women, that all these layers, all these like heavy layers dragging on the ground is not conducive to health. And that, you know, lots of layers that might restrict the body are also not conducive to women's health. And so the reform, if we think of like Amelia Bloomer, right, like and bloomers, right, like if the idea of like simplifying under layers to like one or two layers, and not using corsets, or, you know, just trying to simplify and even raise hemlines off the ground. You know, there are all these ideas about fashion reform and their associations with ideas of health. So when Joseph Smith creates garments, there is no single piece underwear. Everything that I have been able to come to understand about 19th century underwear in America suggests that this does not exist when he creates it. And so in many ways, it reflects many of these goals of fat, like health, women's fashion reform. It is progressive. These are progressive ideas, the idea of reducing layers and creating more ease of movement. So that is a different maybe framing for the origins. So, and there are still lots of stories. And yes, Joseph Smith, you know, was trying to mimic the clothing of what he felt the angels were wearing. It is not clear at all in the record that there is a specific revelation about garments, but rather he feels like he saw the angel wear these items, and he is then wanting to emulate what he felt angels were wearing in his visions. And that it just so happens that the angels are wearing underwear that would be deemed to be kind of new, kind of exciting in the world of underwear. And so that is where we begin. And that is maybe consistent with Joseph Smith's ideas of like finding some new solutions or progressive or playing with different religious ideas. And of course, though, underwear is this thing that is always evolving throughout time. And it gets kind of fixed in time because Joseph instigated this. It gets fixed very quickly. The women think that that garments don't look really finished and that they need more finishing elements. So Emma Smith wants to like attach collars, and Emma Smith's collars that she attaches to the garments like sit under clothing and they're kind of a little more discreet. And Eliza R. Snow is like, no, that's the wrong vision. We need to go big. And so she creates collars that are supposed to be worn on the outside and like kind of peek up through the clothing. So there's this tension between garments being like hidden and visible that goes right back to the beginning, where these women are making changes to those early garments, depending on how they see that they should work in clothing wise.
No, that's so interesting. Thank you so much for giving us this background, which I did not know. I did not know about this early history with Joseph Smith and how these very early garments would actually be considered quite progressive or new or interesting. But yeah, and of course, with time, you know, there are tensions because not only with like the inside outside question, how visible, how not visible, but also tensions because fashions change over time, right? Yeah. And so in the early 1900s, when skirt lines are being raised in women's fashion, but yeah, women's garments are still going down to the ankle, we had a lot of unhappy women in the church, which, yes, and their unhappiness, correct me if I'm wrong, Nancy, did motivate some changes at that point. Is that correct?
So during the lifetime of Joseph F. Smith, you know, they're like, we will die on the hill of, you know, traditional garments. And then once he dies, there is more, like, I think that opens up some room for change. In 1923, the church changes garments. So we go from strings to buttons. We go from wrist and ankle length to more like elbow and like calf length. And knitted fabrics are allowed. That's really important because if you don't know the difference between woven fabrics and knitted fabrics will like stretch and conform to the body, where woven fabrics don't really stretch in the same way. And you can imagine everybody wants stretchy underwear, you know, like you can imagine that not stretchy underwear is going to be like weird and bulky. And that's exactly what younger generations of church members felt. When the new garment patterns come out and the new garments come out, there's a story in the Salt Lake Tribune talking about how the new garments are much healthier, how women wearing garments under their stockings, if you can just imagine the disaster, that they are no longer so knobbly. Like if you can imagine, yeah, right, like non-stretchy and then like trying to put like silk stockings or something over, not like, mm-hmm, like you can just imagine. It's a fashion disaster, people, but like it's a visual disaster because this is not how these items of clothing were intended. It was not intended that there would be layers of clothing underneath things like silk stockings. But when you have long garments, that's kind of what you get. And so shortening the garments allowed for, like, just kind of created a lot more flexibility, and younger generations felt like there was more ease of movement and that these were healthier because these new garments fit with these newer early 20th century ideas about health. In the early 20th century, though, and especially after the First World War, so after like 1918, 1919, clothing gets a lot more simplified. Like in the United States, in Europe, there are a lot fewer layers. There are far fewer structured layers like corsets and the hoop skirts of the, you know, the kind of structuring of clothing from the 19th century doesn't really continue into beyond like the teens and the 20s. And what we also see is that underwear gets a lot smaller at this particular time. And it's really even at this early, in the 20s, underwear gets a lot smaller. So even though the church makes these changes, it's also still, it's kind of at this point now that we're really out of step with a lot of mainstream fashions, or begin become more out of step with mainstream fashions as underwear gets a lot smaller. And of course, underwear always has these meanings around sex and sexuality. And this also becomes more of a problem as church underwear becomes more out of step with fashions, with like worldly, and we can say worldly fashions, but this is also like what's available and what's available in the store. And, you know, people have to figure out how to work with all of this stuff in their lives. So we begin to see these big changes in the 20s. And then there end up being these further incremental changes in the 50s and 60s. Rosemarie Reed, who is an underwear designer and designs swimsuits for movie stars. So Marilyn Monroe is wearing Rosemarie Reed, Mormon swimsuit designer, like swimsuits, and her swimsuits are really fashionable because she's the first person to put a bra on a swimsuit and try to make them like sexy and attractive as opposed to just like athletic wear. She makes a number of recommendations for garment design, including recommending two-piece garments at this time. And she kind of separates men's and women's garments. And so if you've ever felt like garments were full of itchy lace, and my understanding is that the itchy lace no longer exists, but I certainly experience a lot of itchy lace. We can probably thank Rosemary Reed for them. But during her lifetime, the church does not implement two-piece garments. That's kind of a few steps too far. And so we don't get two-piece garments until 1979. And then the church makes lots of incremental changes over the years to the designs, adds fabrics. Rosemary Reed also recommends like nursing garments and maternity garments. And so, you know, she is the person who institutes a lot of those things. But right, like we have, there is a strong feeling within the church, and especially in the early 20th century, and fundamentalists also really kind of really view the original garment pattern as this like deeply invested sacred thing. The church has to like wrestle meaning away from fundamentalists in the 20th century by kind of declaring that the meaning of garments is really in the marks. And by doing so, they're allowed, that kind of creates a pathway for change and for ongoing change, to say that the marks are really invested with meaning. They add a whole commentary on the meaning of the marks to the endowment in the 20s and 30s to kind of solidify that particular change and like invest and kind of wrestle the meaning of garments away from fundamentalists who were really shaping this discourse around like the inherited pattern and the divinity of the inherited pattern. But still, I'm sure many of us in our lives have heard about, right, like inheriting the pattern. And anyway, sorry, I'm going down the garment hole that nobody cares.
No, you're like, good.
It's totally fascinating. No, I appreciate that. And I think that context, it's interesting because I think we can see so many parallels between what you were talking about early on and some of these changes and the health sort of reasons, and then what exactly is going on at this moment with these new changes. So, wow. Margaret, I'll throw it back to you now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I have a question that I want to throw in.
Yeah, go for it, Christine.
So, one of the words you didn't say, Nancy, is modesty. And I heard a lot, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s that the garments, you know, helped to be modest.
Yes.
But I have the sense that that is a later interpolation, and that it doesn't make sense for that to have been the original purpose, because men wore them too. And modesty is just for women, right?
Right. Yeah, so they get invested with meaning around protection, particularly in the wake of Joseph Smith's death. Like Brigham Young capitalizes on that, like, let no man be without his garments, because that becomes the reason why Joseph Smith died, is because he wasn't wearing his garments. And there's a lot of meaning making that happens in the aftermath of his death. And Brigham really seizes this for declaring that then, before Joseph Smith's death, garments were not an all the time thing, but they kind of become an all the time thing after Joseph Smith's death. So they're not really about modesty, they're about protection. And this is really important for the saints who cross the plains and settle Utah, right? Like these meanings around protection, a lot of when the change is made in the 20s, a lot of the older generation are like really scandalized, because they're like, no, our garments are still while we are alive today. This saved us. And then the younger generation are like, we are not having that. And there is a sense then that Brigham Young, especially later in his life and around the founding of Young Women's, wants young women to adopt a kind of like simplicity of their dress. And that's probably to make them less dependent on, you know,
imported goods
and fashions in the East, right? So there's this commerce piece that's like, no, we want Utah to be self-sufficient, so we're going to need everybody to like tone it down with their dress and not put bows on things. So there's modesty in like that sense, but not so much in the sense that you were talking about. There in the 20s, right, like fashion does change, and there is a like some, you know, women start to wear a lot less clothing sometimes, and that's a thing. But the modesty discourse doesn't really seem to enter the fray until the early 50s, as far as I can see. And they're not even tied to garments initially. It's just, but like modest.
Style of our own.
Style of our own. Yeah, that's exactly right. There's this talk that is given called A Style of Our Own And so that begins to change things. But like this idea that garments were always about modesty is just not true. Garments were initially about health and protection. Right. And you can maybe see a kind of relationship between like health and protection, especially in those very earliest years. But then by 1950s, they need a different meaning and they become about modesty. Modesty rhetoric kind of grows out of that time.
Yeah. Metastasizes, as I
think. I like metastasizes. Yeah. And initially lots of stores sold garments. So you could go to a number of different stores in Utah and buy garments and then mark them yourself. And then eventually in the early 20th century, the church creates beehive clothing mills. By the 20s and 30s, by 1930 or so, garment advertising goes away. You're not allowed to advertise garments before. Lots of early Utah publications include a lot of advertisements for garments. And then from there on, garments are really made by beehive clothing. For a while, there was like, this is an official garment tag. So a lot of the story around the making of garments is really one of control, from like anybody can make the garments to like only this place can make the garments. And we absolutely cannot advertise such things. And so there's a lot of like control. And then for a while, you can make your own garment, but you have to use a authorized set as like the pattern. And then, you know, in more recent decades, that sense that you could maybe make your own garments goes away. And so the arc is from less control to more control. And so, you know, even as garments get smaller, the control gets more. And then they are routinely reinvested with new meaning, depending on what project the church leaders are working on and what they see for the community.
So I want to jump back into the release of these garments this week. So Christine, one of the reasons I reached out to you was because you had this, I thought, very insightful Facebook post about the sort of social media public reaction to these images, videos of women, mostly women, you know, standing in lines, going around the corner of, you know, department stores, standing in line possibly for hours, and people really having this sort of denigrating or like making fun of these women, talking about like, hey, are you aware that it's, you know, we're going into winter? Like, why do you care about like getting these now? And you responding with this, I thought, very compassionate, thoughtful point. Can you elaborate on this a little bit? What does the public reaction to the news stories of women lining up to get these garments reveal about assumptions people make regarding faithful, because it is the faithful women, right, standing in line to wear garments, faithful Mormon women's bodies and desires?
Yeah. Sometimes I worry that I have Facebook-sized thoughts and there's actually not much to extrapolate from them. But and I'm glad you thought it was compassionate, because it was honestly born out of a bit of pique. Because I do think there's a way that Latter-day Saints, and I happen to see this response most from men, from Latter-day Saint men, and there's a way that things associated with women get dismissed as silly or insignificant. And there is particularly a way that women's small complaints about lived religion and the way that small things in the church impinge on their comfort and happiness from week to week gets, you know, poo-pooed and dismissed as silly. And there's a way that, you know, each of those small concerns in its way, if it were just the one thing, it would be a little bit silly and trivial to complain about it, but it's not, right? It's Latter-day Saint women's experience is killed by a thousand small cuts and tiny indignities and insults that happen, not even quite on purpose. Like I don't suspect that anyone at any point has sat in the church office building and said, nah, we're going to keep those sleeves. Those, you know, those women, they just, you know, like we're going to control them by making sure they still cover their shoulders. That doesn't happen, but not taking women's experience seriously happens all the time in so many facets of Latter-day Saint life. And so, I think it makes sense to read this, whether or not the women who are standing in line would say it this way. I think it makes sense to read it as, here's one time where women's convenience, women's comfort, even women's desire to dress fashionably, which is a perfectly reasonable desire, matters in a way that makes the church take notice. And so, it doesn't matter to me. I have very much middle-aged shoulders and arms that I'm not eager to show off. I'm probably not buying any sleeveless tops to go with new garments. It's not, that's not the point. But the fact that women's needs matters a lot to me.
I think it's actually, people, there was a lot of frustration and sort of confusion expressed online of like, why are they doing this in the fourth quarter of the year in the Northern Hemisphere? It's cold. And that really rides on the assumption that this is all about wearing tank tops, mm-hmm. right? And so it's kind of interesting to me that it did come out in the fourth quarter when it's cold and still women lined up to get them. So it's clearly not just about wanting to wear tank tops. It's a lot more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. And everything you said about like comfort and health and, feeling good in your body, that's all a lot more than, how many inches you're showing of your shoulder.
Yeah. And just to bounce off of that, I think the biggest change, with these new garment designs, or at least it seems like to me, maybe the most impactful change is that slip option, so that now women don't have to suffer with all these infections, that they were getting because of the design of the bottom parts of the garments. And I also think it's really just important to realize that slip option, I mean, not only is it going to be good for women in the U.S. who do struggle with those things, but also women around the world needed a slip option. In some parts of the world, they have pit toilets. There's nothing to sit on. And so can you imagine trying to perch on one leg and like take off one of these garment bottoms? And then, I mean, it would just be so hard, whereas a slip option would just make so much sense in certain parts of the world. So that's one thing I am. For me, it's the slip that's really that's the important change that I personally as I think about these new garment designs.
Well, and it goes back to, Mansi, what you were saying about the very early desire to simplify undergarments, right? To just make it not quite so cumbersome.
Mm-hmm. And healthier, and talk about health, like that slip option is great. So, yeah, absolutely. And I just want to, I'm thinking about like sort of, bigger questions about garments and thinking about just how fraught garments can be for especially women. And it can symbolize for at least some women both devotion and constraint, because as we've talked about, like it just garments are underwear, and not all underwear, the same type of underwear is not going to be good for all types of bodies, right? And so it's just sort of sometimes a daily struggle depending on the needs of an individual person's bodies. And so I was just wondering if either of you or both of you could reflect on sort of what has happened to women, what does happen to women, their sense of themselves, their psyches, their relationships with the church, when they feel they are duty bound to wear these garments that are not working with their bodies. And I was just kind of wondering if you could comment on that. And also, like, do you know of compromise paths forward? Of course, now we have these new garments that are going to make things maybe slightly easier for some people, but even so, there will still be problems. And I'm just wondering about sort of where is the personal agency here? How have we seen it enacted? How can we envision agency when it comes to these decisions about how, when, and where to wear garments?
I think my own sense of garments changed, and this is going to sound ridiculous, but because of a blog post way back in the early days of blogs, a guy who's a good friend of mine wrote this post about putting on his garments before he went out into the jungle of New York City. And he said, "I can picture Jehovah making these coats of skins for the naked, humiliated Adam and Eve. They realize now that their time in Eden is over and that their relationship with their father will never be the same. I imagine that these first garments were made for them lovingly, made of sturdy stuff to face that lone, dreary world. Surely there must have been an instruction to them about what these clothes meant. And I picture them listening and wondering what it all meant, like my first awkward time in the temple. And then the world changed for them into a hostile, angry place. When I put on my garments, sometimes I think about that moment and remind myself of how God has given me a shield and protection. It's not the magic underwear described by Stern or Marr. It's the constant reminder that I have a relationship with God closer to me than anything else." And I read that and thought it was so lovely. And I had kind of just finished my time of pregnancy and nursing kids, and I definitely did not feel any of those things about my garments, and I wanted to. And for me, at least, that was a moment of figuring out, okay, what part of this experience transmits that meaning to me? And I will choose that part. And, you know, which part of it has changed over time, whether it's, you know, wearing everything exactly the way I was told. I think I switched at that time to wearing my bra underneath, even though I had been instructed by a matron that I was supposed to wear it over so that my garments were next to my skin. And I was like, it just makes me feel weird and makes things slide around. It, you know, it's no good. So I'm not doing it that way. And that became my measuring stick for how I wore them, was how does this help me feel connected and remind me in ways that are helpful and protective of my relationship with God. And, you know, that having that secret holy thing that just I knew about. And I've never since then felt like I needed to be terribly forthcoming in a temple recommend interview about what it was that I was, you know, how I was managing that relationship with God. It became mine. And I think that is an experience that is available to any Latter-day Saint woman or man who wants it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I appreciate that. Yeah, I really appreciate that idea of maybe orienting a bit away from the rule and instead towards the meaning, and then living according to that greater meaning that people want in their lives, which is that connection with God. And so, no, I really appreciate that, Christine. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
I want to go in a slightly different direction, which is around sex and sexuality and our ideas about like sexiness are socially constructed, right? Like they're made by society, right? Like they are made by the society and the world that we live in. And so to put underwear on our bodies, which we are naturally going to associate with sex and sexuality, but to have them represent not that for many Mormon women creates a deep disconnect between like our sense of self and being able to access our sense of a sexual self. And for many men also feel like their wives' garments are deeply off-putting. So many women feel like their own garments create difficulty with accessing their sexual feelings. And men, not men's own garments, but men in viewing women's garments in right heterosexual marriages feel like that's also off-putting. And that creates a lot of difficulty for couples. And this is important, right? Like this, this, if you're supposed to save all of your sexual behavior for marriage, and then you get into marriage and you suddenly find that your religious practice is getting in the way of your sexual relationship, that creates real sadness for people in ways that should absolutely not be dismissed if what we want are happy families, right? Like if we want that, if we want couples to be able to access intimacy and not feel like garments are a form of contraception and of themselves, right? Like it's really important that they can wear underwear, that they can wear garments that aren't actively working against their sense of like, I can be an attractive person and I can inhabit this body and I can feel sexual feelings in this body.
Mm. Yeah, no, thank you. I'm so glad you articulated that. That is a huge disconnect and issue that couples do have to navigate. And so I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, just to wrap up here, can you just each share one quick thought about what you hope the church learns from how women have responded to this change?
I guess I hope that people will see women's faith and recognize that it's okay to reward their faith by hearing them and taking their needs seriously.
Underwear and the practice of garments is like this all the time thing. And so it has to be a thing that works with people's lives. And I'm glad that the church is listening to women in this way. And I think there are probably additional changes and developments and ways that we talk and think about such practices that could also use a little more flexibility in the very ways in which we instruct and around garments. And I hope that that women's needs and that people's needs for health and connection can be like centered instead of seen as a marginal concern or a marginal thing.
Oh, well, Christine and Nancy, thank you so much for joining us. You gave us so much insight and so much knowledge that I think our listeners are going to be really grateful as well. And to our listeners, thank you very much for joining us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please do share it with friends or colleagues. And don't forget to leave us a review and get in touch with us if you have any comments or questions. We hope that you will tune in for future episodes. This is Caroline Klein.
And Margaret Olson Hemming. Until next time, thank you.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.